Releasing an airborne virus underwater was admittedly unusual, and yet there were many life forms that incubated in liquid and then hatched into the air. Mosquitoes, mold spores, the bacterium that caused Legionnaires' disease, mycotoxins, red tide, even human beings. Sinsky grimly pictured the virus permeating the cistern's lagoon, and then the infected microdroplets rising into the damp air. Mirsat was now staring across a traffic-jammed street with a look of apprehension on his face. Sinsky followed his gaze to a squat, red-and-white brick building whose single door was open, revealing what looked to be a stairwell. A scattering of well-dressed people seemed to be waiting outside under umbrellas, while a doorman controlled the flow of guests who were descending the stairs. Some kind of underground dance club? Sinsky saw the gold lettering on the building and felt a sudden tightness in her chest. Unless this club was called the Cistern and had been built in AD 523, she realized why Mirsat was looking so concerned.
"The Sunken Palace," Mirsat stammered. "It seems there is a concert tonight."
Sinsky was incredulous.
"A concert in a cistern?"
"It's a large indoor space," he replied. "It's often used as a cultural center."
Bruder had apparently heard enough. He dashed toward the building, sidestepping his way through snarled traffic on Alemdar Avenue. Sinsky and the others broke into a run as well, close on the agent's heels. When they arrived at the cistern entrance, the doorway was blocked by a handful of concertgoers who were waiting to be let in. A trio of women in burqas, a pair of tourists holding hands, a man in a tuxedo. They were all clustered together in the doorway, trying to keep out of the rain. Sinsky could hear the melodic strains of a classical music composition lilting up from below. Berlioz, she guessed, from the idiosyncratic orchestration. But whatever it was, it felt out of place here in the streets of Istanbul. As they drew closer to the doorway, she felt a warm wind rushing up the stairs, billowing from deep inside the earth and escaping from the enclosed cavern. The wind brought to the surface not only the sound of violins, but the unmistakable sense of humidity and masses of people. It also brought to Sinsky a deep sense of foreboding. As a group of tourists emerged from the stairs, chatting happily as they exited the building, the doorman allowed the next group to descend. Bruder immediately moved to enter, but the doorman stopped him with a pleasant wave.
"One moment, sir. The cistern is at capacity. It should be less than a minute until another visitor exits. Thank you."
Bruder looked ready to force his way in, but Sinsky placed a hand on his shoulder and pulled him off to one side.
"Wait," she commanded. "Your team is on the way, and you can't search this place alone."
She motioned to the plaque on the wall beside the door.
"The cistern is enormous."
The informational plaque described a cathedral-sized subterranean room, nearly 2 football fields in length, with a ceiling spanning more than 100,000 square feet and supported by a forest of 336 marble columns. "Look at this," Langdon said, standing a few yards away. "You're not going to believe it." Sinsky turned. Langdon motioned to a concert poster on the wall.
"Oh, dear God."
The WHO director had been correct in identifying the style of the music as romantic, but the piece that was being performed had not been composed by Berlioz. It was by a different romantic composer, Franz Liszt. Tonight, deep within the earth, the Istanbul State Symphony Orchestra was performing one of Franz Liszt's most famous works, the Dante Symphony, an entire composition inspired by Dante's descent into and return from hell. "It's being performed here for a week," Langdon said, scrutinizing the poster's fine print. "A free concert, underwritten by an anonymous donor." Sinsky suspected that she could guess the identity of the anonymous donor. Bertrand Zobrist's flair for the dramatic, it seemed, was also a ruthless practical strategy. This week of free concerts would lure thousands more tourists than usual down into the cistern and place them in a congested area, where they would breathe the contaminated air, then travel back to their homes both here and abroad.
"Sir," the doorman called to Bruder, "we have room for a couple more."
Bruder turned to Sinsky.
"Call the local authorities. Whatever we find down there, we'll need support. When my team arrives, have them radio me for an update. I'll go down and see if I can get a sense of where Zobrist might have tethered this thing."
"Without a respirator?"
Sinsky asked. You don't know for a fact the Solyublan bag is intact.
Bruder frowned, holding his hand up in the warm wind that was blowing out of the doorway.
I hate to say this, but if this contagion is out, I'm guessing everyone in this city is probably infected.
Sinsky had been thinking the same thing, but hadn't wanted to say it in front of Langdon and Mirsat.
Besides, Bruder added, I've seen what happens to crowds when my team marches in wearing hazmat suits. We'd have full-scale panic and a stampede.
Sinsky decided to defer to Bruder. He was, after all, the specialist, and had been in situations like this before.
Our only realistic option, Bruder told her, is to assume it's still safe down there and make a play to contain this.
Okay, Sinsky said. Do it.
There's another problem, Langdon interjected. What about Sienna? What about her? Bruder demanded. Whatever her intentions may be here in Istanbul, she's very good with languages and possibly speaks some Turkish.
So?
Sienna knows the poem references the sunken palace, Langdon said, and in Turkish, sunken palace literally points, he motioned to the Yerbatan Sarayi sign over the doorway. Here.
That's true, Sinsky wearily agreed. She may have figured this out and bypassed Hagia Sophia altogether.
Bruder glanced at the lone doorway and cursed under his breath.
Okay, if she's down there and plans to break the Solyublan bag before we can contain it, at least she hasn't been there long. It's a huge area, and she probably has no idea where to look. And with all those people around, she probably can't just dive into the water unnoticed.
Sir,
the doorman called again to Bruder,
would you like to enter now?
Bruder could see another group of concertgoers approaching from across the street, and nodded to the doorman that he was indeed coming.
I'm coming with you, Langdon said, following.
Bruder turned and faced him.
No chance.
Langdon's tone was unyielding. Agent Bruder, one of the reasons we're in this situation is that Sienna Brooks has been playing me all day. And as you said, we may all be infected already. I'm helping you whether you like it or not.
Bruder stared at him a moment, and then relented.
As Langdon passed through the doorway and began descending the steep staircase behind Bruder, he could feel the warm wind rushing past them from the bowels of the cistern. The humid breeze carried on it the strains of Liszt's Dante Symphony, as well as a familiar yet ineffable scent, that of a massive crush of people congregated together in an enclosed space. Langdon suddenly felt a ghostly pall envelop him, as if the long fingers of an unseen hand were reaching out of the earth and raking his flesh. The music, the symphony chorus, 100 voices strong, was now singing a well-known passage, articulating every syllable of Dante's gloomy text.
Lasciate ogni speranza, they were now chanting, voi entrate.
These 6 words, the most famous line in all of Dante's Inferno, welled up from the bottom of the stairs like the ominous stench of death. Accompanied by a swell of trumpets and horns, the choir intoned the warning again.
Lasciate ogni speranza voi che entrate.
Abandon all hope, ye who enter here. Chapter 91. Bathed in red light, the subterranean cavern resonated with the sounds of hell-inspired music, the wail of voices, the dissonant pinch of strings, and the deep roll of timpani, which thundered through the grotto like a seismic tremor. As far as Langdon could see, the floor of this underground world was a glassy sheet of water, dark, still, smooth, like black ice on a frozen New England pond, the lagoon that reflects no stars. Rising out of the water, meticulously arranged in seemingly endless rows, were hundreds upon hundreds of thick Doric columns, each climbing 30 feet to support the cavern's vaulted ceiling. The columns were lit from below by a series of individual red spotlights, creating a surreal forest of illuminated trunks that telescoped off into the darkness like some kind of mirrored illusion. Langdon and Bruder paused at the bottom of the stairs, momentarily stalled on the threshold of the spectral hollow before them. The cavern itself seemed to glow with a reddish hue, and as Langdon took it all in, he could feel himself breathing as shallowly as possible. The air down here was heavier than he'd imagined. Langdon could see the crowd in the distance to their left, The concert was taking place deep in the underground space. Halfway back against the far wall, its audience seated on an expanse of platforms. Several hundred spectators sat in concentric rings that had been arranged around the orchestra, while 100 more stood around the perimeter. Still others had taken up positions out on the near boardwalks, leaning on the sturdy railings and gazing down into the water as they listened to the music. Langdon found himself scanning the sea of amorphous silhouettes, his eyes searching for Sienna. She was nowhere in sight. Instead, he saw figures in tuxedos, gowns, bishts, burkas, and even tourists in shorts and sweatshirts. The cross-section of humanity gathered in the crimson light looked to Langdon like celebrants in some kind of occult mass. If Sienna's down here, he realized, it will be nearly impossible to spot her. At that moment, a heavy-set man moved past them, exiting up the stairs, coughing as he went. Bruder spun and watched him go, scrutinizing him carefully. Langdon felt a faint tickle in his own throat, but told himself it was his imagination. Bruder now took a tentative step forward on the boardwalk, eyeing their numerous options. The path before them looked like the entrance to the Minotaur's labyrinth. The single boardwalk quickly forked into three, each of those branching off again, creating a suspended maze hovering over the water, weaving in and out of the columns and snaking into the darkness. I found myself within a forest dark, Langdon thought, recalling the ominous first canto of Dante's masterwork, for the straightforward pathway had been lost. Langdon peered over the walkway's railing into the water. It was about 4 feet deep and surprisingly clear. The stone tile floor was visible, blanketed by a fine layer of silt. Bruder took a quick look down, gave a non-committal grunt, and then raised his eyes back to the room.
Do you see anything that looks like the area in Zobrist's video?
Everything, Langdon thought, surveying the steep, damp walls around them. He motioned to the most remote corner of the cavern, far off to the right, away from the congestion of the orchestral platform.
I'm guessing back there somewhere.
Bruder nodded. My instinct as well.
The two of them hurried down the boardwalk, choosing the right-hand fork, which carried them away from the crowd in the direction of the farthest reaches of the sunken palace. As they walked, Langdon realized how easy it would be to hide overnight in this space, undetected. Zobrist could have done just that to make his video. Of course, if he had generously underwritten this week-long concert series, he also could have simply requested some private time in the cistern. Not that it matters any more. Bruder was striding faster now, as if subconsciously keeping pace with the symphony's tempo, which had increased into a cascading series of descending semitone suspensions. Dante and Virgil's descent into hell. Langdon intently scanned the steep, mossy walls in the distance to their right, trying to match them up with what they had seen in the video. At each new fork in the boardwalk, they turned right, moving farther from the crowd, heading for the cavern's most remote corner. Langdon looked back and was astounded by the distance they had covered. They advanced at almost a jog now, passing a handful of meandering visitors. But by the time they entered the deepest parts of the cistern, the number of people had thinned to nothing. Bruder and Langdon were alone.
It all looks the same, Bruder despaired. Where do we start?
Langdon shared his frustration. He remembered the video vividly, but nothing down here leaped out as a recognizable feature. Langdon studied the softly lit informational signs that dotted the boardwalk as they moved ahead. One described the 21 million gallon capacity of the room. Another pointed out a non-matching pillar that had been looted from a nearby structure during construction. And still another offered a diagram of an ancient carving now faded from view. The crying hen's eye symbol, which wept for all the slaves who died while building the cistern. Strangely, it was a sign that bore a single word that now stopped Langdon dead in his tracks. Bruder halted too, turning.
What's wrong?
Langdon pointed. On the sign, accompanied by a directional arrow, was the name of a fearsome gorgon. An infamous female monster. Medusa. Bruder read the sign and shrugged.
So what?
Langdon's heart was pounding. He knew Medusa was not only the fearsome snake-haired spirit whose gaze could turn anyone who looked at her to stone, but was also a prominent member of the Greek pantheon of subterranean spirits, a specific category known as the Thonic Monsters. Follow deep into the sunken palace, for here, in the darkness, the Thonic Monster waits. She's pointing the way, Langdon realized, breaking into a run along the boardwalk. Bruder could barely keep up with him as Langdon zigzagged into the darkness, following the signs for Medusa. Finally, he reached a dead end at a small viewing platform near the base of the cistern's rightmost wall. There before him was an incredible sight. Rising out of the water was a colossal carved marble block, the head of Medusa, her hair writhing with snakes. Making her presence here even more bizarre was the fact that her head had been placed on her neck upside down. Inverted as the damned, Langdon realized, picturing Botticelli's map of hell and the inverted sinners he had placed in the Malabolge. Bruder arrived breathless beside Langdon at the railing, staring out at the upside-down Medusa with a look of bewilderment. Langdon suspected that this carved head, which now served as a plinth supporting one of the columns, had probably been pillaged from elsewhere and used here as an inexpensive building supply. The reason for Medusa's inverted position was, no doubt, the superstitious belief that the inversion would rob her of her evil powers. Even so, Langdon could not shake off the barrage of haunting thoughts that assailed him. Dante's Inferno, the finale, the center of the earth, where gravity inverts itself, where up becomes down. His skin now prickling with foreboding, Langdon squinted through the reddish haze that surrounded the sculpted head. Most of Medusa's serpent-infested hair was submerged underwater, but her eyes were above the surface, facing to the left, staring out across the lagoon. Fearfully, Langdon leaned over the railing and turned his head, letting his gaze follow the statues out into the familiar empty corner of the sunken palace. In an instant, he knew. This was the spot. Zobrist's Ground Zero. Chapter 92. Agent Bruder lowered himself stealthily, sliding beneath the railing and dropping down into the chest-deep water. As the rush of cool liquid permeated his clothing, his muscles tensed against the chill. The floor of the cistern was slippery beneath his boots, but it felt solid. He stood a moment, taking stock, watching the concentric circles of water rippling away from his body like shock waves across the lagoon. For a moment, Bruder didn't breathe.
"Move slowly," he told himself. "Create no turbulence."
Above him on the boardwalk, Langdon stood at the railing, scanning the surrounding boardwalks.
"All set," Langdon whispered. "Nobody sees you."
Bruder turned and faced the huge upside-down head of Medusa, which was brightly lit by a red spotlight. The inverted monster looked even larger now that Bruder was down at her level.
"Follow Medusa's gaze across the lagoon," Langdon whispered. "Zobrist had a flair for symbolism and dramatics. I wouldn't be surprised if he placed his creation directly in the lethal sightline of Medusa."
"Great minds think alike."
Bruder felt grateful that the American professor had insisted on making the descent with him. Langdon's expertise had guided them almost immediately to this distant corner of the cistern. As the strains of the Dante Symphony continued to reverberate in the distance, Bruder took out his waterproof Tovatec penlight and submerged it beneath the water, flipping the switch. A bright halogen beam pierced the water, illuminating the cistern floor before him.
"Easy," Bruder reminded himself. "Don't disturb a thing."
Without another word, he began his careful journey out into the lagoon, wading in slow motion through the water, moving his flashlight methodically back and forth, like an underwater minesweeper. At the railing, Langdon had begun to feel an unsettling tightness in his throat. The air in the cistern, despite the humidity, tasted stale and oxygen depleted to him. As Bruder waded carefully out into the lagoon, the professor reassured himself that everything would be fine.
"We arrived in time. It's all intact. Bruder's team can contain this."
Even so, Langdon felt jumpy. As a lifelong claustrophobe, he knew he would be anxious down here under any circumstances.
"Something about thousands of tons of earth hovering overhead, supported by nothing but decaying pillars."
He pushed the thought from his mind and took another glance behind him for anyone taking undue interest. Nothing. The only people nearby were standing on various other boardwalks, and they were all looking in the opposite direction, toward the orchestra. No one seemed to have noticed Bruder slowly wading across the water in this deep corner of the cistern. Langdon returned his gaze to the SRS team leader, whose submerged halogen beam still oscillated eerily in front of him, lighting the way. As Langdon looked on, his peripheral vision suddenly picked up a movement to his left, an ominous black form rising out of the water in front of Bruder. Langdon wheeled and stared into the looming darkness, half expecting to see some kind of leviathan rearing up from beneath the surface. Bruder had stopped short, apparently having seen it too. In the far corner, a wavering black shape rose some 30 feet up the wall. The ghostly silhouette looked nearly identical to that of the plague doctor who'd appeared in Zobrist's video.
It's a shadow, Langdon realized, exhaling. Bruder's shadow.
The shadow had been cast as Bruder moved past a submerged spotlight in the lagoon, exactly, it seemed, as Zobrist's shadow had done in the video.
This is the spot, Langdon called out to Bruder. You're close.
Bruder nodded and continued inching his way out into the lagoon. Langdon moved along the railing, staying even with him. As the agent moved farther and farther away, Langdon stole another quick glance toward the orchestra to make sure Bruder had not been noticed. Nothing. As Langdon again returned his gaze to the lagoon, a glint of reflected light caught his eye on the boardwalk at his feet. He looked down and saw a tiny puddle of red liquid. Blood. Strangely, Langdon was standing in it.
Am I bleeding?
Langdon felt no pain, and yet he frantically began searching himself for some injury or possible reaction to an unseen toxin in the air. He checked his nose for a possible bleed, his fingernails, his ears. Baffled as to where the blood had come from, Langdon glanced around, confirming that he was indeed alone on the deserted walkway. Langdon looked down at the puddle again, and this time he noticed a tiny rivulet flowing along the boardwalk and collecting in the low spot at his feet. The red liquid, it seemed, was coming from somewhere up ahead and trickling down an incline in the boardwalk.
Someone is injured up there, Langdon sensed.
He glanced quickly out at Bruder, who was nearing the center of the lagoon. Langdon strode quickly up the boardwalk, following the rivulet. As he advanced toward the dead end, the rivulet became wider, flowing freely.
What in the world?
At this point, it turned into a small stream. He broke into a jog, following the flowing liquid all the way to the wall, where the boardwalk suddenly ended.
Dead end.
In the murky darkness, he found a large pool, which was glistening red, as if someone had just been slaughtered here. In that instant, as Langdon watched the red liquid dripping off the boardwalk into the cistern, he realized that his original assessment was mistaken. It's not blood. The red lights of the vast space, combined with the red hue of the boardwalk, had created an illusion, giving these clear droplets a reddish-black tint. It's just water. Instead of bringing a sense of relief, the revelation infused him with blunt fear. He stared down at the puddle of water, now seeing splashes on the banister and footprints. Someone climbed out of the water here. Langdon spun to call out to Bruder, but he was too far away, and the music had progressed into a fortissimo of brass and timpani. It was deafening. Langdon suddenly felt a presence behind him.
I'm not alone out here.
In slow motion, Langdon turned toward the wall where the boardwalk dead-ended. 10 feet away, shrouded in dark shadows, he was able to discern a rounded form, like a large stone cloaked in black cloth, dripping in a pool of water. The form was motionless. And then it moved. The form elongated, its featureless head rotating upward from its bowed position. A person huddled in a black burqa, Langdon realized. The traditional Islamic body covering left no skin showing, but as the veiled head turned toward Langdon, two dark eyes materialized, staring out through the narrow slit of the burqa's face covering, locking intently on Langdon. In an instant, he knew. Sienna Brooks exploded from her hiding place. She accelerated to a sprint in a single stride, plowing into Langdon and driving him to the ground as she raced off down the boardwalk. Chapter 93. Out in the lagoon, Agent Bruder had stopped in his tracks. The halogen beam of his Tovatec penlight had just picked up the sharp glint of metal up ahead on the submerged cistern floor. Barely breathing, Bruder took a delicate step closer, cautious not to create any turbulence in the water. Through the glassy surface, he could now make out a sleek rectangle of titanium bolted to the floor. Zobrist's plaque. The water was so clear, he could almost read tomorrow's date and accompanying text. In this place, on this date, the world was changed forever.
Think again, Bruder mused, his confidence rising. We have several hours to stop this before tomorrow.
Picturing Zobrist's video, Bruder gently inched the flashlight beam to the left of the plaque, searching for the tethered Soljeblon bag. As the beam illuminated the darkened water, Bruder strained his gaze in confusion.
No bag.
He moved the beam farther to the left, to the precise spot where the bag had appeared on the video. Still nothing.
But it was right here.
Bruder's jaw clenched as he took another tentative step closer, sweeping the beam slowly around the entire area.
There was no bag, only the plaque.
For a brief, hopeful instant, Bruder wondered if perhaps this threat, like so many things today, had been nothing but an illusion.
Was it all a hoax? Did Zobrist just want to scare us?
And then he saw it. To the left of the plaque, barely visible on the lagoon floor, lay a limp tether. The flaccid string looked like a lifeless worm in the water. At the far end of the string was a tiny plastic clasp, from which hung a few tatters of Soljeblon plastic. Bruder stared down at the frayed relic of the transparent bag. It clung to the end of the tether like the tattered knot of a popped party balloon. The truth settled slowly in his gut.
We're too late.
He pictured the submerged bag dissolving and breaking apart, its deadly contents spreading out into the water and bubbling up to the surface of the lagoon. With a tremulous finger, he flicked off his flashlight and stood a moment in the darkness, trying to gather his thoughts. Those thoughts turned quickly to prayer.
God, help us all.
Agent Bruder, repeat, Sinsky shouted into her radio, descending halfway down the stairwell into the cistern, trying to get better reception.
I didn't copy that.
The warm wind rushed past her up the stairs toward the open doorway above. Outside, the SRS team had arrived, and its members were prepping behind the building in an effort to keep their hazmat gear out of sight while they waited to receive Bruder's assessment.
Ruptured bag, Bruder's voice crackled in Sinsky's calm. And released.
What?
Sinsky prayed she was misunderstanding as she rushed farther down the stairs.
Repeat,
she commanded, nearing the base of the stairwell where the orchestral music grew louder. Bruder's voice was much clearer this time.
And I repeat, the contagion has been dispersed.
Sinsky lurched forward, nearly falling into the cistern's entryway at the base of the stairwell.
How can that be?
The bag has dissolved, Bruder's voice snapped loudly. The contagion is in the water.
A cold sweat gripped Dr. Sinsky as she raised her eyes and tried to process the sprawling underground world now spread out before her. Through the reddish haze, she saw a vast expanse of water, from which sprang hundreds of columns. Most of all, however, she saw people. Hundreds of people. Sinsky stared out at the unsuspecting crowd, all of them confined in Zobrist's underground death trap. She reacted on instinct.
Agent Bruder, come up at once. We'll begin evacuating people immediately.
Bruder's reply was instantaneous.
Absolutely not. Seal the doors. Nobody gets out of here.
As director of the World Health Organization, Elizabeth Sinsky was accustomed to having her orders followed without question. For an instant, she thought she had misunderstood the lead SRS agent's words.
Seal the doors?
Dr. Sinsky, Bruder shouted over the music. Do you read me? Close the goddamn doors!
Bruder repeated the command, but it was unnecessary. Sinsky knew he was correct. In the face of a possible pandemic, containment was the only viable option. Sinsky reflexively reached up and gripped her lapis lazuli amulet. Sacrifice the few to save the many. With a hardening resolve, she raised the radio to her lips.
Confirmed, Agent Bruder. I'll give the order to seal the doors.
Sinsky was about to turn away from the horror of the cistern and give the command to seal the area when she sensed a sudden commotion in the crowd. Not far away, a woman in a black burqa was dashing toward her along a crowded boardwalk, knocking people out of the way as she ran. The veiled woman seemed to be headed directly for Sinsky and the exit.
She's being chased,
Sinsky realized, spotting a man running behind her. Then Sinsky froze.
That's Langdon.
Sinsky's eyes whipped back to the woman in the burqa, who was approaching fast and now shouting something in Turkish to all the people on the boardwalk. Sinsky didn't speak Turkish, but judging from the panicked reaction of the people, the woman's words were the equivalent of shouting fire in a crowded theater. A ripple of panic swept through the crowd, and suddenly it was not only the veiled woman and Langdon who were dashing for the stairs. Everyone was. Sinsky turned her back to the oncoming stampede and began shouting desperately up the stairs to her team.
Lock the doors! Sinsky screamed. Seal the cistern now!
By the time Langdon skidded around the corner into the stairwell, Sinsky was halfway up the stairs, clambering toward the surface, shouting wildly to close the doors. Sienna Brooks was close on her heels, struggling with her heavy, wet burqa as she lumbered up the stairs. Bounding after them, Langdon could feel a tidal wave of terrified concertgoers surging up behind him.
Seal the exit!
Sinsky shouted again. Langdon's long legs carried him three steps at a time, gaining fast on Sienna. Above, he could see the cistern's heavy double doors begin to swing inward.
Too slow.
Sienna overtook Sinsky, grabbing her shoulder and using it as leverage to launch past her, clambering wildly over her toward the exit. Sinsky stumbled forward onto her knees, her beloved amulet hitting the cement stairs and breaking in half. Langdon fought the instinct to stop and help the fallen woman, but instead he hurtled past her, sprinting toward the top landing. Sienna was only a few feet away now, almost within reach, but she had attained the landing and the doors were not closing fast enough. Without breaking stride, Sienna deftly angled her slender body and leaped sideways through the narrow opening. She was halfway through the doors when her burqa snagged on a latch, halting her in her tracks, wedged in the middle of the doorway, mere inches from freedom. As she writhed to escape, Langdon's hand shot out and seized a clump of her burqa. He held fast, pulling back, trying to reel her in, but she wriggled frantically and suddenly Langdon was holding only a wet clump of fabric. The doors slammed onto the fabric, barely missing Langdon's hands. The wadded cloth was now pinched in the doorway, making it impossible for the men outside to push the doors all the way closed. Through the narrow slit, Langdon could see Sienna Brooks sprinting across a busy street, her bald head shining in the streetlights. She was wearing the same sweater and blue jeans she had been wearing all day, and Langdon suddenly felt a fiery, upwelling sense of betrayal. The feeling lasted only an instant. A sudden, crushing weight rammed Langdon hard against the door. The stampede had arrived behind him. The stairwell echoed with shouts of terror and confusion as the sounds of the symphony orchestra deteriorated into a confused cacophony below. Langdon could feel the pressure on his back increasing as the bottleneck thickened. His ribcage began to compress painfully against the door. Then, the doors exploded outward and Langdon was launched into the night like a cork from a bottle of champagne. He stumbled across the sidewalk, nearly falling into the street. Behind him, a stream of humanity was flowing up out of the earth like ants escaping from a poisoned anthill. The SRS agents, hearing the sounds of chaos, now emerged from behind the building. Their appearance in full hazmat gear and respirators immediately amplified the panic. Langdon turned away and peered across the street after Sienna. All he could see was traffic and lights and confusion. Then, for a fleeting instant, down the street to his left, the pale flash of a bald head shone in the night, darting along a crowded sidewalk and disappearing around a corner. Langdon shot a desperate glance behind him, searching for Sinsky or the police, or an SRS agent who was not wearing a bulky hazmat suit. Nothing. Langdon knew he was on his own. Without hesitation, he sprinted after Sienna. Far below, in the deepest recesses of the cistern, Agent Bruder stood all alone in the waist-deep water. The sounds of pandemonium echoed through the darkness as frenzied tourists and musicians shoved their way toward the exit and disappeared up the stairs. The doors were never sealed, Bruder realized to his horror. Containment has failed. Chapter 94. Robert Langdon was not a runner, but years of swimming made for powerful legs, and his stride was long. He reached the corner in a matter of seconds and rounded it, finding himself on a wider avenue. His eyes urgently scanned the sidewalks. She's got to be here. The rain had stopped, and from this corner, Langdon could clearly see the entire well-lit street. There was nowhere to hide. And yet Sienna seemed to have vanished. Langdon came to a stop, hands on his hips, panting as he surveyed the rain-soaked street before him. The only movement he saw was 50 yards ahead, where one of Istanbul's modern autobuses was pulling away from the curb and powering up the avenue. Did Sienna jump on a city bus? It seemed far too risky. Would she really trap herself on a bus when she knew everyone would be looking for her? Then again, if she believed nobody had seen her round the corner, and if the bus had been just pulling away by chance, offering a perfectly timed opportunity, maybe. Affixed to the top of the bus was a destination sign, a programmable matrix of lights displaying a single word, Galata. Langdon rushed up the street toward an elderly man who was standing outside a restaurant under an awning. He was nicely dressed in an embroidered tunic and a white turban.
"Excuse me," Langdon said, breathless, arriving before him. "Do you speak English?"
"Of course," the man said, looking unnerved by the urgency of Langdon's tone.
"Galata? That's a place?"
"Galata," the man replied. "Galata Bridge, Galata Tower, Galata Port." Langdon pointed to the departing autobus.
"Galata, where is the bus going?"
The man in the turban looked after the departing bus and considered it a moment.
"Galata Bridge," he replied. "It departs the old city and crosses the waterway."
Langdon groaned, his eyes making another frantic pass of the street but seeing no hint of Sienna. Sirens blared everywhere now, as emergency response vehicles tore past them in the direction of the cistern.
"What's happening?"
the man demanded, looking alarmed.
"Is everything okay?"
Langdon took another look at the departing bus and knew it was a gamble, but he had no other choice.
"No, sir," Langdon replied. "There's an emergency, and I need your help."
He motioned to the curb, where a valet had just delivered a slick silver Bentley.
"Is that your car?"
"It is, but I need a ride," Langdon said. "I know we've never met, but something catastrophic is happening. It's a matter of life and death."
The turbaned man stared into the professor's eyes a long moment, as if searching his soul. Finally, he nodded.
"Then you'd better get in."
As the Bentley roared away from the curb, Langdon found himself gripping his seat. The man was clearly an experienced driver and seemed to enjoy the challenge of weaving in and out of traffic, playing catch-up with the bus. It took him less than 3 blocks to position his Bentley directly behind the autobus. Langdon leaned forward in his seat, squinting at the rear window. The interior lights were dim, and the only things Langdon could make out were the vague silhouettes of the passengers.
"Stay with the bus, please," Langdon said. "And do you have a phone?"
The man produced a cell phone from his pocket and handed it to his passenger, who thanked him profusely before realizing that he had no idea whom to call. He had no contact numbers for Sinsky or Bruder, and calling the WHO's offices in Switzerland could take forever.
"How do I reach the local police?" Langdon asked.
155. The man replied. "Anywhere in Istanbul."
Langdon dialed the 3 numbers and waited. The line seemed to ring forever. Finally, a recorded voice answered, conveying both in Turkish and English that due to high call volume, he would need to hold. Langdon wondered if the reason for the call volume was the crisis at the cistern. The sunken palace was now probably in a state of total pandemonium. He pictured Bruder wading out in the lagoon and wondered what he had discovered out there. Langdon had a sinking feeling he already knew. Sienna had gotten into the water before him. Up ahead, the bus's brake lights flashed, and the transport pulled over to a curbside bus stop. The Bentley's driver pulled over as well, idling about 50 feet behind the bus, providing Langdon a perfect view of the passengers getting on and off. Only 3 people disembarked, all of them men, and yet Langdon studied each carefully, fully aware of Sienna's skills for disguise. His eyes shifted again to the rear window. It was tinted, but the lights inside were now fully illuminated, and Langdon could see the people on board more clearly. He leaned forward, craning his neck, holding his face close to the Bentley's windshield as he searched for Sienna.
"Please don't tell me I gambled wrong."
Then he saw her, in the rearmost part of the vehicle, facing away from him, a pair of slender shoulders sloped up to the back of a shaved head.
It could only be Sienna.
As the bus accelerated, the interior lights faded once more. In the fleeting second before it disappeared into darkness, the head turned backward, glancing out the rear window. Langdon lowered himself down in the seat, into the shadows of the Bentley.
Did she see me?
His turbaned driver was already pulling out again, tailing the bus. The road was descending toward the water now, and up ahead Langdon could see the lights of a low-slung bridge that stretched out over the water. The bridge looked completely deadlocked with traffic. In fact, the entire area near its entrance looked congested.
"Spice bazaar," the man said, "very popular on rainy nights."
The man pointed down to the water's edge, where an incredibly long building sat in the shadow of one of Istanbul's more spectacular mosques. The new mosque, if Langdon were not mistaken, judging from the height of its famed twin minarets. The Spice Bazaar looked larger than most American malls, and Langdon could see people streaming in and out of its enormous arched doorway.
"Allo?" a tiny voice declared somewhere in the car. "A childurum. Allo?"
Langdon glanced down at the phone in his hand.
"The police."
"Yes, hello," Langdon blurted, raising the receiver. "My name is Robert Langdon. I'm working with the World Health Organization. You have a major crisis at the city cistern, and I'm tailing the person responsible. She's on a bus near the Spice Bazaar, heading for..."
"One moment, please," the operator said. "Let me connect you with dispatch."
"No, wait!" But Langdon was on hold again. The Bentley's driver turned to him with a look of fear.
"A crisis at the cistern?"
Langdon was about to explain when the driver's face suddenly glowed red like a demon.
"Brake lights."
The driver's head whipped around and the Bentley skidded to a stop directly behind the bus. The interior lights flickered on again and Langdon could see Sienna as plain as day. She was standing at the back door, yanking repeatedly on the emergency stop cord and banging to get off the bus.
"She saw me," Langdon realized.
No doubt Sienna had also seen the traffic on Galata Bridge and knew she could not afford to get caught in it. Langdon opened his door in a flash. But Sienna had already bolted from the bus and was sprinting into the night. Langdon tossed the cell phone back to its owner.
"Tell the police what happened. Tell them to surround this area."
The turbaned man gave a frightened nod.
"And thank you," Langdon shouted.
"Teşekkürler."
With that, Langdon dashed down the hill after Sienna, who was running directly toward the crowds milling around the Spice Bazaar. Chapter 95. Istanbul's 300-year-old Spice Bazaar is one of the largest covered marketplaces in the world. Built in the shape of an L, the sprawling complex has 88 vaulted rooms divided into hundreds of stalls, where local merchants zealously hawk a mind-boggling array of edible pleasures from around the world. Spices, fruits, herbs, and Istanbul's ubiquitous candy-like confection, Turkish Delight. The bazaar's entryway, a massive stone portal with a Gothic arch, is located on the corner of Çiçek Pazarı and Tahmis Street, and is said to witness the passage of more than 300,000 visitors a day. Tonight, as Langdon approached the swarming entrance, he felt as if all 300,000 were here at that very moment. He was still running hard, his eyes never leaving Sienna. She was now only 20 yards ahead of him, racing directly toward the bazaar's gateway, and showing no signs of stopping. Sienna reached the arched portal and came up hard against the crowd. She snaked through the people, clawing her way inside. The moment she crossed the threshold, she stole a glance backward. Langdon saw in her eyes a frightened little girl, running scared, desperate and out of control.
Sienna!
He shouted, but she plunged into the sea of humanity and was gone. Langdon dove in after her, bumping, pushing, craning his neck until he spotted her weaving down the bazaar's western hallway to his left. Burgeoning casks of exotic spices lined the way. Indian curry, Iranian saffron, Chinese flower tea, their dazzling colors creating a tunnel of yellows, browns, and golds. With every step, Langdon smelled a new aroma, pungent mushrooms, bitter roots, musky oils, all wafting through the air with a deafening chorus of languages from around the world. The result was an overwhelming rush of sensory stimuli set against the unceasing thrum of people. Thousands of people. A wrenching feeling of claustrophobia gripped Langdon, and he almost pulled up before gathering himself again and forcing his way deeper into the bazaar. He could see Sienna just ahead, pushing through the masses with adamant force. She clearly was taking this ride to the end, wherever that might be for her. For a moment, Langdon wondered why he was chasing her. For justice? Considering what Sienna had done, Langdon could not begin to fathom what kind of punishment awaited her if she were caught. To prevent a pandemic? Whatever had been done was done. As Langdon pushed through the ocean of strangers, he suddenly realized why he wanted so badly to stop Sienna Brooks. I want answers. Only 10 yards ahead, Sienna was headed for an exit door at the end of the western arm of the bazaar. She stole another quick glance behind her, looking alarmed to see Langdon so close. As she turned again, facing front, she tripped and fell. Sienna's head snapped forward, colliding with the shoulder of the person in front of her. As he went down, her right hand shot out, searching for anything to break her fall. She found only the rim of a barrel of dried chestnuts, which she seized in desperation, pulling it over on top of her and sending a landslide of nuts across the floor. It took Langdon 3 strides to reach the spot where she had fallen. He looked down at the floor but saw only the toppled barrel and the chestnuts. No Sienna. The shopkeeper was screaming wildly.
Where did she go?
Langdon spun in a circle, but Sienna had somehow vanished. By the time his gaze landed on the western exit only 15 yards ahead, he knew that her dramatic fall had been anything but accidental. Langdon raced to the exit and burst out into an enormous plaza, also crowded with people. He stared into the plaza, searching in vain. Directly ahead, on the far side of a multi-lane highway, Galata Bridge stretched out across the wide waters of the Golden Horn. The dual minarets of the new mosque rose to Langdon's right, shining brightly over the plaza, and to his left was nothing but open plaza packed with people. The sound of blaring car horns drew Langdon's gaze ahead again, toward the highway that separated the plaza from the water. He saw Sienna, already 100 yards away, darting through speeding traffic and narrowly avoiding being crushed between 2 trucks. She was headed for the sea. To Langdon's left, on the banks of the Golden Horn, a transportation hub bustled with activity. Ferry docks, autobuses, taxis, tour boats. Langdon sprinted hard across the plaza toward the highway. When he reached the guardrail, he timed his leap with the oncoming headlights and safely bounded across the first of several 2-lane highways. For 15 seconds, assaulted by blinding headlights and angry car horns, Langdon managed to advance from median to median, stopping, starting, weaving, until he finally vaulted over the final guardrail onto the grassy banks of the sea. Although he could still see her, Sienna was a long way ahead, eschewing the taxi stand and idling buses and heading directly for the docks, where Langdon saw all manner of boats moving in and out, tourist barges, water taxis, private fishing boats, speedboats. Out across the water, city lights twinkled on the western side of the Golden Horn, and Langdon had no doubt that if Sienna reached the other side, there would be no hope of finding her, probably ever. When Langdon finally reached the waterfront, he turned left and dashed along the boardwalk, drawing startled looks from tourists who were queued up waiting to board a flotilla of gaudily decorated dinner barges, complete with mosque-like domes, faux gold flourishes, and blinking neon trim. Las Vegas on the Bosporus, Langdon moaned, powering past. He saw Sienna far ahead, and she was no longer running. she was stopped on the dock in an area cluttered by private powerboats, pleading with one of the owners.
Don't let her aboard.
As he closed the gap, he could see that Sienna's appeal was directed at a young man who stood at the helm of a sleek powerboat that was just preparing to pull away from the dock. The man was smiling, but politely shaking his head no. Sienna continued gesticulating, but the boater appeared to decline with finality, and he turned back to his controls. As Langdon dashed closer, Sienna glanced at him, her face a mask of desperation. Below her, the boat's twin outboards revved, churning the water and moving the craft away from the dock. Sienna was suddenly airborne, leaping off the dock over the open water. She landed with a crash on the boat's fiberglass stern. Feeling the impact, the driver turned with an expression of disbelief on his face. He yanked back the throttle, idling the boat, which was now 20 yards from the dock. Yelling angrily, he marched backward toward his unwanted passenger. As the driver advanced on her, Sienna effortlessly stepped aside, seizing the man's wrist and using his own momentum to launch him up and over the stern gunwale. The man plunged headlong into the water. Moments later, he rose to the surface, sputtering and thrashing wildly, and shouting a string of what were no doubt Turkish obscenities. Sienna seemed detached as she tossed a flotation cushion into the water, moved to the helm of the boat, and pushed the dual throttles forward. The engines roared, and the boat sped off. Langdon stood on the dock, catching his breath, as he watched the sleek white hull skimming away across the water, becoming a ghostly shadow in the night. Langdon raised his eyes toward the horizon, and knew that Sienna now had access not only to the distant shores, but also to an almost endless web of waterways that stretched from the Black Sea to the Mediterranean. She's gone. Nearby, the boat's owner climbed out of the water, got to his feet, and hurried off to call the police. Langdon felt starkly alone as he watched the lights of the stolen boat growing faint. The whine of the powerful engines was growing distant as well. And then the engines faded abruptly to silence. Langdon peered into the distance. Did she kill the motor? The boat's lights seemed to have stopped receding and were now bobbing gently in the small waves of the Golden Horn. For some unknown reason, Sienna Brooks had stopped. Did she run out of gas? He cupped his hands and listened, now able to hear the faint thrum of her engines idling. If she's not out of gas, what is she doing? Langdon waited. 10 seconds, 15 seconds, 30 seconds. Then, without warning, the engines revved up again, reluctantly at first, and then more decidedly. To Langdon's bewilderment, the boat's lights began banking into a wide turn, and the bow swung around toward him. She's coming back. As the boat approached, Langdon could see Sienna at the wheel, staring blankly ahead. 30 yards away, she throttled down and eased the boat safely back to the dock it had just left. Then she killed the engines. Silence. Above her, Langdon stared down in disbelief. Sienna never looked up. Instead, she buried her face in her hands. She began trembling, her shoulders hunched and shuddering. When she finally looked at Langdon, her eyes were overflowing with tears.
Robert, she sobbed, I can't run away anymore. I have nowhere left to go.
Chapter 96.
It's out.
Elizabeth Sinsky stood at the bottom of the cistern stairwell and gazed at the void of the evacuated cavern. Her breathing felt strained through the respirator she was wearing, although she had probably already been exposed to whatever pathogen might be down here. Sinsky felt relieved to be wearing a hazmat suit as she and the SRS team entered the desolate space. They were dressed in bulbous white jumpsuits that locked into airtight helmets, and the group looked like a team of astronauts breaching an alien spacecraft. Sinsky knew that upstairs on the street, hundreds of frightened concertgoers and musicians were huddling in confusion, many being treated for injuries suffered in the stampede. Others had fled the area entirely. She felt lucky to have escaped with only a bruised knee and a broken amulet.
Only one form of contagion travels faster than a virus, Sinsky thought. And that's fear.
The doors upstairs were now locked, hermetically sealed, and guarded by local authorities. Sinsky had anticipated a jurisdictional showdown with the arriving local police, but any potential conflicts had evaporated instantly when they saw the SRS team's biohazard gear and heard Sinsky's warnings of a possible plague.
We're on our own,
the director of the WHO thought, staring out at the forest of columns reflected in the lagoon.
Nobody wants to come down here.
Behind her, two agents were stretching a huge polyurethane sheet across the bottom of the stairwell and sealing it to the wall with a heat gun. Two others had found an open area of boardwalk planks and had begun setting up an array of electronic gear as if preparing to analyze a crime scene.
That's exactly what this is, Sinsky thought. A crime scene.
She again pictured the woman in the wet burqa who had fled the cistern. By all appearances, Sienna Brooks had risked her own life in order to sabotage the WHO's containment efforts and fulfill Zobrist's twisted mission.
She came down here and broke the Soljublan bag.
Langdon had chased Sienna off into the night, and Sinsky had still not received word regarding what had happened to either of them.
I hope Professor Langdon is safe, she thought.
Agent Bruder stood dripping on the boardwalk, staring blankly out at the inverted head of Medusa, and wondering how to proceed. As an SRS agent, Bruder had been trained to think on the macrocosmic level, setting aside any immediate ethical or personal concerns and focusing on saving as many lives as possible over the long term. Threats to his own health had barely registered on him until this moment.
I waded into this stuff, he thought,
chastising himself for the risky action he had taken, and yet knowing he'd had little choice.
We needed an immediate assessment.
Bruder forced his thoughts to the task at hand. Implement Plan B. Unfortunately, in a containment crisis, Plan B was always the same.
Widen the radius.
Fighting communicable disease was often like fighting a forest fire. Sometimes you had to drop back and surrender a battle in hopes of winning the war. At this point, Bruder had still not given up the idea that a full containment was possible. Most likely, Sienna Brooks had ruptured the bag only minutes before the mass hysteria and evacuation. If that were true, even though hundreds of people had fled the scene, everyone might have been located far enough away from the source to avoid contamination.
Everyone except Langdon and Sienna, Bruder realized, both of whom were here at Ground Zero and are now someplace out in the city.
Bruder had another concern as well, a gap in logic that continued to nag at him. While in the water, he had never found the actual breached Soljublan bag. It seemed to Bruder that if Sienna had broken the bag, by kicking it or ripping it or whatever she had done, he would have found the damaged, deflated remnants floating somewhere in the area. But Bruder had found nothing. Any remains of the bag seemed to have vanished. Bruder strongly doubted that Sienna would have carried off the Soljublan bag with her, since by this point it would have been no more than a slimy, dissolving mess.
So where did it go?
Bruder had an uneasy sense that he was missing something. Even so, he focused on a new containment strategy, which required him to answer one critical question.
What is the contagion's current dispersal radius?
Bruder knew the question would be answered in a matter of minutes. His team had set up a series of portable virus detection devices along the boardwalks at increasing distances from the lagoon. These devices, known as PCR units, used what was called a polymerase chain reaction to detect the presence of viral contamination. The SRS agent remained hopeful. With no movement of the water in the lagoon and the passage of very little time, he was confident that the PCR devices would detect a relatively small region of contamination, which they could then attack with chemicals and the use of suction.
Ready?
A technician called out through a megaphone. Agents stationed around the cistern gave the thumbs up.
Run your samples,
the megaphone crackled. Throughout the cavern, analysts crouched down and started their individual PCR machines. Each device began analyzing a sample from the point at which its operator was located on the boardwalk, spaced in ever-widening arcs around Zobrist's plaque. A hush fell across the cistern as everyone waited, praying to see only green lights. And then it happened. On the machine closest to Bruder, a virus detection light began flashing red. His muscles tensed, and his eyes shifted to the next machine. It too began blinking red.
No.
Stunned murmurs reverberated throughout the cavern. Bruder watched in horror as, one by one, every PCR device began blinking red all the way across the cistern to the entrance.
Oh, God,
he thought. The sea of blinking red detection lights painted an unmistakable picture. The radius of contamination was enormous. The entire cistern was teeming with virus.